I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. They have come so agonizingly close. The World Health Organization, now in its 16th year of a global campaign to eradicate polio, had this disease down to just a few hundred cases. It was going to take just one more push in Africa and in Asia, and polio would become like smallpox, officially wiped out. But in just the past couple of years, the fight against polio has faltered. Some of the developing nations have lost their enthusiasm. In some places, the vaccine itself is being shunned. Muslim leaders have been warning villagers that the vaccine's part of an American plot to spread AIDS and cause infertility. And so, once again, the WHO is rallying its volunteers and its politicians, determined not to lose momentum in the battle against polio. Two questions today. Is the fight against polio the right fight? Should health organizations be focusing on wiping out one disease that kills hundreds when conditions like gastroenteritis, malaria, and cholera are killing so many more? And beyond the numbers, there's a larger question. Should people be required or forced to take a vaccine if it violates their particular beliefs? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me today here in the studio, the doctor and journalist Atul Gawande. His latest piece in The New Yorker describes the struggle against polio in India. And as I was saying to Atul just moments before the program began, I also saw that back in 97. Part of what was striking about your piece was that they're still at it. The campaign is still underway.
Yes, you describe when you were working in Delhi, going out and seeing the massive numbers of people who had to be mobilized to vaccinate what turned out to be millions of children. And here we are, it's 2004, and exactly that, they're still at it.
You use the words in your piece, Atul, that this could be potentially mankind's single most ambitious accomplishment. Now, maybe borrowing some of the language from the WHO there, I'm not sure, but why do you put it in such grand terms like that?
Well, I'm not borrowing their terms at all. I put it in such grand terms because it is a worldwide effort. It's imagine just trying to get the world to all jump at the same time, and now you're trying to tackle a disease which is mostly invisible. Smallpox was hard enough. There you had visible blisters and lesions that instantly or quickly appeared, and you could vaccinate everybody in a ring around those people. Polio, for every one person who turns up paralyzed, there are between 200 and 1,000 who have just a subclinical upset stomach. And so you see one case of polio, and you already know you're dealing with hundreds of people who have the virus spreading around. And then to tackle one case, not just one case, but thousands of cases around the world, has been a massive effort. I went to India and decided to just follow around a team who were responding to one infection in southern India, a boy.
A mop-up is what it was called.
Yeah,
right?
They called it a mop-up. Sounds like a nice, small, tidy operation. A small boy of about 11 months old, had gotten paralyzed after a couple days of a flu bug. They thought it was a flu bug. And tested 2 weeks later to have polio. So they responded as quickly as they could to vaccinate everybody around the boy. They did some calculations to figure out how many people that would involve. And then they told me what it would be. 4.2 million children they needed to vaccinate in 3 days. They mobilized 37,000 vaccinators, thousands of vehicles. They had to have a way of keeping all of the vaccine cold, delivering it, getting it produced and sent to this area. And this is for one boy. By the time I went with the team, and by the time we got to the area, there were already 9 other visibly paralyzed children, plus you knew there were hundreds of others who were simply infected.
And were you running into, in that trip, people who were not interested in either taking the vaccine or who had been told not to take the vaccine? What did you hear? What did you see?
Absolutely. You saw it in two ways. First of all, India had, like you mentioned, come down to only a couple hundred cases. And then in 2002, in the north, in Muslim areas, there had been the strong suspicion spreading that that the government was slipping something in the vaccine to make Muslim boys impotent. And so it started to spread again like wildfire in the north. They started to contain that by involving Muslim leaders in the campaign and by publicity campaigns and really fighting that. But by the time we got to the south of India, when I was there just a few months ago, we went to one village called Balkundi, and you could run into people who just simply didn't want it. There was one young woman who had three children with her, one on her hip, who when the vaccinators came along just said, "No, thank you, I don't want any." People would press, they'd ask, they'd say, "Well, this is, you know, there was actually a polio case right down the street. Do you want your kids to get polio?" And she'd say, no, I don't. But no, thank you. No vaccine." And then, and so we walked away. The local doctor we saw come up a minute later and start screaming at the woman, saying, "Are you going to kill you're going to kill your child." What was striking to me was that the WHO doctor went back and yelled, not at the woman, but at the doctor, the local doctor, because he argued that you would do more damage trying to force this vaccine on this woman by all the nasty rumors that could get started than simply letting it go.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the WHO campaign to try and wipe out polio. I want to bring John Donnelly in on the conversation now. John is joining us, actually covers Africa for the Boston Globe and has been covering this campaign for some considerable period of time. John's joining us from Limpopo Province in South Africa. John, nice to have you with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I read a piece recently of yours, John, from Batakai in Nigeria, where you were also talking about this word of an American plot tied up with the vaccine. What were the people saying to you there?
Well, it was actually, there are quite a few of the Muslim leaders in northern Nigeria had spent a lot of time on the internet looking back to the 1970s with the time in the 60s, the time of Nixon and Kissinger, and pointed out, and they cited by number some National Security Council documents, which said that one way to assure American dominance in the world was to depopulate the Third World. And they were using some of that logic to say that, well, here is indeed how it will play out with something like with the polio vaccine. So there was some degree of at least sophistication in terms of looking up and doing research on the internet and trying to attach one piece of logic to another, which was in my mind was obviously a disconnect. But I think they're looking for things because of all kinds of suspicions with these polio vaccine rounds.
And did the people themselves want the vaccine, despite what they were hearing from their leaders?
You know, I think in these last six countries around the world, one of the things that characterizes in each of the places is a lack of education among the majority of people. And so many people who I met in Nigeria and who I've met before in other polio rounds in Afghanistan and Angola, just didn't know all that much about what was going on and were willing to follow what their local community leaders were saying. I think it contrasted in one place that I went to in Nigeria, though, where I did go to a village where there were four fairly recent cases of polio. And the people in that village, in Batakai, who are all Muslim, all really wanted the polio vaccine because they actually saw their neighbors' children become paralyzed.
What struck me as well, John, was, you know, as you trace it back through when they get the advice and when they choose not to take the vaccine, just how quickly the disease can still spread. I mean, you're talking about new cases in countries like Benin and Cameroon, which had been declared polio-free. And if you look at the map, you see that they're both on either side of Nigeria. And the suspicion is that because the disease is not being stamped out in Nigeria, that it's spreading. Do people in that part of West Africa see it the same way?
I think they're starting to. I think there's starting to be more publicity in radios and newspapers about the fact that, you know, from northern Nigeria, there are now seven countries that have had cases of polio in the last couple of months, which had been polio free for many years. So I think they're starting to get out. The leaders of those countries are starting to put some heat on Nigeria to do something about this. But I think one thing to keep in mind is some sense of perspective here. It's indeed polio can spread pretty easily out of regions because kids are traveling through and they get infected when they're visiting people. But I think one of the things that all these polio partners right now are lucky about is that there haven't been a whole lot of cases so far. I mean, there've been maybe 24 cases or a little more than 24 in these countries. It's very worrisome, but it's not huge outbreaks.
Let me turn to Atul Gawande here in the studio with me, because it seems to me, as I look through your work on this, Atul, that that's in fact part of the problem, that if the vaccine's not been taking, people in these distant country towns and villages aren't seeing sweeping epidemics of the disease.
That's right. The one place where you tend to see people really eager for the vaccine are places where they've had an outbreak in their own neighborhood. And even then, when you go to a village that has had polio appear, most of the people are simply doing it because it's the thing that you're supposed to do. They're following orders, so to speak. Then you get the concern that if it's only a few cases breaking out in a few places, that the recognition isn't there until it's already spread and out of control.
And you're hearing questions from people who are saying, why do you government officials come back year after year with the polio vaccine when we have all these other diseases?
That was the most interesting question to watch the WHO doctors respond to as we walked around, because people in almost every village we went to would say, why polio? We've had cholera come through here, and there was no infantry that came down to tackle the disease. We have malnutrition. We had a failure of the monsoon this year, and our crops were wiped out. But here, one boy has his legs go out from under him, and the whole government seems to sweep down. And their response would sometimes be, well, we're going to fix everything. And you know that's not true, and the villagers would know that's not true. The response at other times would be a little more sophisticated. They would say, look, we're doing what we can. This was a problem that was infecting hundreds of thousands of people per year, and now we have it down to just a handful. And if we can just make this push, we will wipe it off the face of the earth. And the value of that would be incalculable. But right now, here and now, we've spent $3 billion. It's going on up, stopping a disease that is now down to just a handful of cases. And so you look at a country like India, it's going to spend $200 million in the next year trying to stop a handful of cases. And people are starting to say, where's the math?
Good questions for our listeners. Where is the math when so much money is spent on such a small number of cases or outbreaks? Or do we need to take a broader, longer-term look at what the effect of polio coming back in some of these countries could be? What are the ethics of this type of vaccination program, and how do you see it? Our number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. I'm Dick Gordon. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. This hour we're talking about the WHO's 16th year of its campaign to try and eradicate polio, some of the difficulties that it's running into. With me on the program, Atul Gawande. He's a surgeon and assistant professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. Has been writing for The New Yorker for the past 6 years, and his latest piece takes him to India and the efforts in that country to look after the last few cases of polio. John Donnelly's also with us. He covers Africa for the Boston Globe. Last month he was in Batakai, Nigeria, where he was talking with people who are resisting the polio vaccine. And John, I wanted to ask you to pick up where Atul left off there with the questions that people have about the vaccine. Are there people in Africa who are also saying, hey, why all this attention just on polio?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are quite a few people raising those questions because of other more pressing problems that they see day to day. But I think that, you know, especially as they get to the final stages of trying to wipe out polio, that I think we also need to step back a few steps as well, because, I mean, I'm sure a lot of listeners, older listeners to the program, can remember during the 40s and 50s in the United States about what fear communities had in the United States about polio, and about towns where there's swimming pools in the summer that got shut down because someone in town got infected with polio. And now that we're down to the last few countries, it would seem in many ways a shame to give up the fight and look at this from a greater distance and say, you know, we're very close to wiping out a disease for only the second time in human history, you know, smallpox being the first time. Mm-hmm. And there will be a huge benefit to everyone, not just to countries where they have good, intact health systems.
It is one of the interesting dilemmas that as you get down to a few cases, you actually have to spend more money to tackle them, and then the cost-benefit analysis starts to fall apart. But one of the ways that I've begun to think of this is that this is one of the few things that we can do as a civilization that will last for a great long time. We don't build pyramids. We have not created our Great Wall to last thousands of years. But for our generation, this is our grand accomplishment, grander in many ways than going to the moon.
So what are the two of you saying? That if necessary, people ought to be forced to take the vaccine? Is the end game that important?
Well, the irony is that trying to force people to take the vaccine only drives them underground. It would be far less effective to have people at gunpoint and say, you must take this vaccine. If you want villages to actually cooperate and go along with the effort, that means trying to convince them that this is the right thing to do. And that's an extraordinarily hard thing, but it is part of what is in the nature of making a human campaign like this actually succeed.
John, what do you think?
Well, I think he's right. I think that I think that you need, in some ways, the talent of persuasion in many places. And it's going to be very difficult in Nigeria because of the political issues and the ideological anti-American issues. The opposition to this is solely as a way to, among some people, to get back at the U.S. for its war against two Muslim countries, Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I think I think there needs to be some thought about how do you approach people that oppose this on such strong, seemingly unshakable grounds. And I think there needs to be finally some promises made about attending to some other health problems in communities where they actually will be forced to fulfill these promises, unlike many other ones made in this polio campaign.
I think John's right on the score, because many of these are the poorest, least politically powerful regions with high Muslim concentrations in India that a year ago had outbreaks very much like the one in Nigeria. And there, some of the complaints were absolutely spot on. You had places where government officials were not paying any attention to the healthcare problems. And so why is it surprising that the Muslim populations would not trust what they're bringing to them? And so it does require a real repair to damage that has been long done.
And the U.S. link that John just referred to, mentioning the two recent wars against Muslim countries, is this what is behind the resistance to the drug? Some link between the U.S. and the vaccine, and then a resistance based on not liking the policies of this particular government?
So I think John certainly found that in Nigeria and India, it's a response to the Hindu-dominated government. It becomes a sort of sectarian battle in a similar way. But it doesn't take long to point out to people that this is a WHO resolution, that the U.S. government has hardly been thought to be a turning either the UN or WHO into their own wing of political goals, and furthermore that every country in the world, including Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, and many Muslim countries, have signed on to this as their pledge and their effort. And so you do see these arguments. You hear them. In India, they successfully they spent a year. It took a solid year, but they successfully have fought it back with a real public relations campaign.
So, but John, what you're saying is it is a backlash to what's called here the war on terror.
It's definitely a backlash. I think it's nuanced. There are many factors involved in northern Nigeria, which I think will be ultimately be the hardest place to get right. But I think things snowball, and I think rumors, you know, become another kind of rumor, and then all of a sudden it becomes some very savvy, politically savvy people in different areas saying, well, let's, you know, we the U.S. has a lot at stake at this. Let's draw attention to our position, and this is the way of doing it. And I think, you know, I think actually that this whole campaign is in quite a bit of trouble right now. I think they've put a pretty tight timetable to finish this by the end of 2004 this year, and they have not really, in at least in northern Nigeria and perhaps in other places, really got the end game down yet.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Worcester, Mass. Now, and Ben, you're with the program. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just think it's an important point, this fact to point out that, you know, I'm one of the first generations not to need a smallpox vaccine, and we still vaccinate children multiple times through their youth for polio. And what I think needs to be advocated is the fact that we could, you know, eradicate this. We're so close to eradicating it to where now we don't have to give vaccines that are no longer seem necessary. There are parents in the United States that are not vaccinating their children for fears of side effects. And this is one of the, you know, great possible benefits if this campaign is successful.
That even if it costs hundreds of millions of dollars to go after the last dozen cases in some distant village or however it plays out, that money ought to be spent, is what you're saying, Ben?
I think so. And the other thing is how much money will be saved over the next, you know, 50 to 100 years of polio vaccines that don't need to be given ever again.
Do we measure that, Atul? Is there any way of taking a look at other countries that are polio-free?
Well, the interesting thing is that even though we are polio-free, he's exactly right, that we continue to have to vaccinate people because as long as it's there in the world, one virus would spread in our population.
So the fact that it's in Cameroon is the reason why kids in San Francisco are still getting the polio vaccine.
That is correct. And it'll be 2 years of seeing that the world is completely polio-free before you start to see us ending vaccination of children here. So he's right. There is a cost that goes into what we have to do now, even because of the disease being in India and Nigeria. The real question is about this whole gamble. John alluded to his worry that this is a gamble that may be failing. I'm on the optimistic side because I've been struck by the fact that they've fought back time and time again. It's taken longer, and so did smallpox. But the whole idea of using eradication as the way we spend our money in public health, spend billions upon billions of dollars to get rid of just one disease rather than build an infrastructure that actually takes care of a variety of diseases or simply fix the sewage systems around the world, a lot less glamorous. And yet sometimes you do need these kinds of campaigns to keep the public in the game, to have volunteers and people actually willing to fight for a goal.
All right, Ben, thanks for that call. Let's go to Raleigh, North Carolina. Greg, you're with us now. Thanks for calling.
Good morning to you, gentlemen. Mr. Gordon, I'm honored to be on your program. I think a lot of you.
Nice to have you here. Go ahead.
The money that we're spending to eradicate polio, we're spending that money, as was just mentioned, because we're afraid as Americans that the disease might migrate in our direction again. So we're still spending the money to vaccinate our own children.
It's okay to be selfish in one sense, though, isn't it, Greg? I mean, if the vaccinations are being spread around the world out of self-interest, it still helps those people in West Africa, though, right?
Correct, except that I've got several friends who were afraid to get a flu vaccine this year because they were afraid of what our own government was putting in it. Now, call that paranoia, and I do. But I just saw a poll. USA Today just released a poll, I believe it was the middle of this past year, that showed a large percentage of our own African-American population were afraid of vaccinations and flu vaccine because they were afraid of what was going in it. There are all kinds of conspiracy theories and nuts on the net saying all kinds of crazy things. It's not surprising to me that a Muslim population across the planet, you know, on the other side of the planet, would read that and think, you know what, maybe we better think twice about this, especially if it's going to be forced on them.
If you go back, and I think you did some of this, Atul, in your work to the earlier vaccines, there was a mercury-based additive that was designed to decontaminate the vaccine, and there were concerns at that time that it could possibly trigger allergies or autism. I mean, is that what people are looking at when they raise questions about the safety of the vaccine even today?
That's right. There's still this ongoing controversy about the relationship between the vaccines used in the 50s and autism. And then there is all of the concerns just around vaccination and whether it harms immune systems. I think there's pretty good evidence that that vaccines are not only safe but tremendously important. But many of the populations the caller describes are ones that have not trusted vaccines, and it's led to real consequences. We had an outbreak in Philadelphia of measles, a disease that should not appear in the United States. And this was just a matter of about a decade ago that you had a serious outbreak of measles because enough people did not want the vaccine, refused the vaccine, that it started to spread among children.
John Donnelly, I see in the news that there was a gathering of health ministers from among six countries talking about what they can do to redouble their efforts to get the vaccine for polio used in their countries. One of those gentlemen was the health minister from Nigeria, and I was looking at a BBC story this morning quoting him saying that the national immunization campaign would restart next month and would cover all of Nigeria's northern states. Are those just words? Can these guys make that happen?
I mean, I think Nigeria is under incredible pressure right now. I mean, I think they know that if they're the last country in the world that still has polio, that it will be an incredible embarrassment to them. So I think he's going to be saying these things, and there's no reason to believe yet that he can pull it off. But I think he's under a lot of pressure, and a lot of heat. So I think we should just take it for the pressure he's under. But I think what the caller said before I think is a great point, in that you know, you're in a village, your health system is completely broken down. You've had two kids die already before the age of five, and now you have this great big program coming in five times a year to immunize everyone for a disease you've never seen. I would be suspicious too if I didn't know what was going on.
1-800-423-8255. Back to the phones to Calhoun County, South Carolina, and Gloria. You're with us. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I just wanted to say that, you know, I have four children that were born in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, I did not initially give them the polio vaccine because of the very things we're talking about today, and that's here in this country. I was told that the vaccinations could possibly give the children polio, so I was extremely reluctant. And so I understand very clearly how, as has been said previously, things like this are happening overseas.
What happened in your case, Gloria? Did your doctor talk you into it?
Well, eventually, you know, I found myself very much between a rock and a hard place. Of course, I didn't want my children to contract polio. But I also did not want to be responsible if they did get it, that if I had not vaccinated them. And I just had a pediatrician who stayed with me. And each time that I would come in, he would show me at various different reports. And eventually, my conscience bothered me so much that I just decided to do it. And thank God my children are grown today and very healthy, so it was the right move. But I can understand overseas where there are so many stories, and with with so much AIDS in Africa today and people not knowing where it came from. Again, even in this country, there are those who believe that it was something that was planted in Africa by our own government.
You know, I want to play something for you, Gloria. This is a little piece from a film clip from 50 years ago when the United States government was at that time dealing with questions and concerns and uncertainty about how safe the polio vaccine was from its very beginning. So they would use infomercials like this one.
Living tissue is inoculated with poliomyelitis vaccine, incubated, then carefully examined. The monkey test, one of the most important tests. 20 monkeys are involved in the testing of every lot of vaccine, and each receives 3 injections from the manufacturer's sample. The purpose? Once again, to confirm the safety and effectiveness of the polio vaccine. These are just some of the painstaking review and testing procedures of the National Institutes of Health, each contributing to the final judgment and recommendation on every lot of vaccine. Once the Public Health Service authorizes its release, the polio vaccine can begin to protect American youngsters.
Interesting just to listen to that and hear the tone of it, Atula. But the message, the concern, the questions, boy, they're still the same.
That's right. You have to, you know, this is... Medicine is thought of as something that has tremendous certainty, but it is always with a degree of uncertainty about whatever treatment that you are going in for. And at a certain point, you're putting yourself in the hands of a whole lot of people, the people who are going to operate on you or the people who have put this vaccine together, delivered it in ice carriers across hundreds of miles and come to your doorstep to drop it on your child's tongue. And not everybody is going to trust that process. Most people will recognize that the gamble of not going ahead with these kinds of care is worse than foregoing the vaccine. But this is a campaign that has a shot. So people are starting to understand that.
1-800-423-8255. As I said at the beginning of the program, the World Health Organization is so agonizingly close to actually eradicating polio. They've been successful with one other disease, that is smallpox, a number of others not so successful. What do you think about the how much should be put behind the campaign? I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The World Health Organization is in its 16th year of a campaign to eradicate polio around the world. They were to have succeeded in their 12th year, but they keep pushing the deadline off because polio keeps popping up in places in Africa and in Asia, in part because people are a little bit fed up with the ongoing campaigns, in part for other reasons that we've been talking about in the program, where people have serious questions or suspicions about the drugs and whether or not coming from the United States or being linked up with the U.S. In fact, they carry something other than the vaccine in the oral dose that's administered. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, John Donnelly, who covers Africa for the Boston Globe, and Atul Gawande, who's assistant professor at the Harvard School of Public Health and writes and wrote recently about this in the New Yorker magazine. Would it make any sense, Atul, if the people who came to the doors were a little bit broader in their focus and handed out some vitamins that might supplement a certain area to stop blindness, that might say, let's have a look at your house and see where your latrine is and where you're getting your drinking water, rather than this sort of bullish, single-minded polio, polio, polio. I've seen it. You've seen it.
Yeah, it does make some sense. And certainly vitamin A has been given as along with the polio drops in some countries and been a tremendous effect against blindness. And yet this is so complicated to just make this one thing work. You have to train people to know how to use, tens of thousands of people know how to use the vaccine. What does the little marker on it mean? Does that mean that it's fresh and does it mean it has to be thrown away? When you give the drops, do you give one drop, two drops? Do you put it on the tongue? How do you make sure that all the kids are in the house? Just that training alone is tremendously difficult. And what you're raising is the real uncertainty about what you might call the lottery approach to public health. This is putting all our eggs in one basket, spending billions of dollars, and it will be worthless if we fail. And we have failed before. In the 1950s and 60s, you had the multi-billion dollar campaign against malaria that didn't succeed. You had the campaign against yellow fever that didn't succeed. And actually, in the 70s, the WHO started to give up on the whole idea of eradication as a goal. Smallpox was dragging on, and it was not succeeding. And then it succeeded. And just when they were giving up on the idea of doing eradication, they were going to instead put money in building good primary health centers around the world. They said, well, let's keep working on the primary health centers, but my God, let's go after polio. It's already been eliminated from the Americas.
1-800-423-8255. Next call from Jay, New York, and Pam, you're with us. Thanks for calling.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Fine, thanks.
I was calling. I thought someone who has some experience here in the country with polio would be a good addition. I had polio as a child and missed 1 year of school. Our house was quarantined. My sister couldn't go to school. My mother had polio as well and went to a hospital 100 miles away from where we lived, so I kind of grew up without a mom when I was sick. And I just feel like if there's one more disease or any disease that we could eradicate, that we should do that.
Does it frustrate you, Pam, when you hear people say, you know, polio is pretty well gone, the vaccinations are a risk, I think I'm just going to skip the vaccinations, whether you hear that here in this country or from somewhere in a place like Africa?
Well, I think it's sad. I really do. I always had to have the vaccines, and I always said, well, I had it. You know, I shouldn't have to have them. But there are many ways to get it, and it seems when we're so close that we should do it because it will come back, and then we're back where we started.
John Donnelly, Atul here in the studio talks about it as the lottery approach, where you just, you know, you put all that cash into one campaign and you push it and you really hope that it can work. Just in general, based on the experience that you've had traveling in so many of those villages in Africa, is that the way to go?
Well, I think that there needs to be a broader approach. But that said, I think that there's something can be won here from victory in eliminating polio. I think that if the global health community, and this includes not just the WHO, but it includes UNICEF, it includes a private organization like Rotary that has raised millions of dollars for this. I think it shows that a public health, there can be a huge public health victory. There's results that politically that money can be spent in some of the poorest places in the world with tangible results, and it could be a lift. So that even though I think that a lot of the polio campaign blew it in many of these villages by not adding something like vitamin A, which it is a complication, but it's not that great a complication. I think now that we're this close, if they seal it, if they actually are able to eliminate it, it may help lead to other funds for health projects.
There is a certain degree of frustration sometimes that I have about it. I was in India at the time doing a study of surgical care there, not a study of polio, although I found this such an important campaign. I joined along to see how it went. And when I went to many of these same villages, what I would recognize is that now the number one cause of death in India is heart disease, that cancer rates are on the rise because people are living to 7 years of age and longer, that car crashes. They don't have a system of trauma care. And I spend the bulk of my time working on how do we improve systems like that for countries that only have $4 per person per year and they have somebody on their doorstep with a heart attack. And you see millions upon millions going for this effort. And yet, even I walk away thinking, if we can secure this victory, it will have meaning for many of the villages my own parents come from. And it does not knock off the blocks the idea that we still try to make forward progress on public health across the board.
Well, the point that you make in your article, I think, is important here, and that is that the infrastructure that has been built up over the 16 years, if that's not continued to be used, it'll never be built up again, right? So in that sense, we are at something of a moment.
That's right.
You know, if you let it lag and lose the volunteers and the training. Right.
And you take it or it's gone.
1-800-423-8255. Pam, thanks for your phone call to Westwood, Massachusetts. And Michael's joining us now. Hi, Michael.
Yeah, hi, Dick. Thank you for taking the call. I've been listening for about 50 minutes now, and this has been a wonderful program. I wanted just to add a little bit about the partners that the World Health Organization has had in this effort, because Rotary International specifically tends to be left out of it. And Dr. Donnelly said earlier that the World Health Organization had almost given up or had given up on eradication efforts in the late 70s. And I think the reason that it changed that policy was because of Rotary International getting involved in the polio eradication effort in the mid-80s and making a commitment to eradicating it worldwide, hopefully by 2005 now. And
I know, Michael, that the Rotarians are play an instrumental part in raising millions for this. Can you tell me from your perspective, from what you know about it, why it is that the Rotary Clubs, Rotary International chose polio and has put the shoulder behind this particular eradication plan?
Well, it started in the Philippines in the mid-80s with a Rotarian out there who felt that they could do it in a limited area in the Philippines. And from that experience, they determined that it was an achievable goal and something that Rotary could do. But beyond the financial commitment, which is well about $600 million at this point, individual Rotarians have been traveling all over the world for these immunization days at their own expense, where they will go to India and to Africa and various other places and administer the serum. There's been examples of warring factions stopping fighting for a day in order to have the immunization day. And it's because Rotary has been able to do that because they've been able to deal with individual Rotarians rather than governmental agencies or political figures, et cetera.
You raise an interesting point, which is that Rotary or WHO is actually a powerless organization. They don't run governments. In India, they have a handful of doctors trying to go along. And what they have to have is, number one, it's the governments themselves that run the campaigns. Number two, you have UNICEF actually producing and distributing the vaccine. And then you have this funny role of Rotary, which has raised a whole lot of money. But I found there was an behind-the-scenes role, which I didn't expect. In Delhi, for example, the head of Rotary there is the guy who runs the Hilton Hotels. He owns the Hilton Hotels. He's got a ton of money. And he's one of the few people who can get the prime minister on the phone. And that behind-the-scenes aspect of things, that there are people in the private side who have a line into the high government levels, but also into Muslim populations and poverty-stricken populations, is not a small part of this. Part of the reason why it's succeeding is you have this network that can reach in from the side.
Is it that widespread in Africa, John, in your experience?
Oh, very much. Very, very much. I think there's a lot of local chapters. In fact, in Nigeria, there's a the leader of Rotary International right now is a Nigerian based in the States. But so there is a lot of activity, and it's what's interesting now is to watch different groups lobby Rotary to try to get them interested in the next campaign. I know there's some movement on to do something on the HIV vaccine. But the ripple effect, the hope is among these partners like WHO and UNICEF, is that other voluntary service organizations like Rotary will see this example and take up a cause themselves.
It's one of the few ways that they can say that this is not entirely the government's going on doing this work here, that this can be ordinary people from the community who have embraced this.
You know, though, there are, I mean, aside from all the best intentions, also lots of reasons to despair over the way it's done. You describe it at one point, Atul, the difficulty of trying to keep the vaccine itself cold in some parts of India.
I went with Pankaj Bhatnagar, who was one of the monitors who went to supervise how well this vaccination program was going. And we went to a little clinic where there had been an outbreak of polio in that area. And the doctor, we asked them to explain, okay, how are you keeping the stuff cold? And they said, well, we have 100 ice packs that we distribute to all the volunteers. I said, well, this is 3 days of keeping the vaccine cold. What happens when the ice packs melt? Well, we refreeze it. Well, show me the freezer. We went to the freezer, and the doctor put his hand in. It didn't seem all that cold. Took out a thermometer. It wasn't cold at all. He said, well, we've had power outages. And he said, well, what's your solution for that? He said, well, we have a backup power generator. So, well, show me the power generator. We went to the power generator. It didn't work. and you sat there and just thought, how do you make this work? And yet we would go around place after place. We found three encampment settlements, which don't appear on any maps, places where within the last couple of months, migrant workers had simply set up camp with lots and lots of kids who would likely, I was sure, not have any vaccination. And we just stopped our SUV, got out and walked among the tents and found that every child there had been vaccinated during that campaign. There are holes, and I don't know how sometimes it all gets strung together, but what Bhatnagara had done for that village that had no working ice machine was he found a ice factory that could deliver blocks of ice, and then the vaccine was kept cold.
There is, John, a sort of despite all odds sense that you know has brought them at least this far.
It's very true. It's I also went to many places in Afghanistan while the Taliban still ruled, and I would go out with a vaccinator, and we would just drive in the desert for hours and come up upon just tents, and he would go and vaccinate them. So there are amazing efforts being done by literally hundreds of thousands of people in this.
John, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thank you.
John Donnelly covers Africa for the Boston Globe. Atul Gawande, nice to have you here in the studio.
Great to be here.
Atul is surgical resident in Boston and assistant professor at the Harvard School of Public Health. His article about polio, The Mop-Up, appeared in a recent edition of The New Yorker. Our program is produced by Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arik Karitsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugart. Our interns are Jennifer Giles and Matt Miller. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Thank you.